The Tom Woods Show, episode 2071.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, when you criticize the Federal Reserve, you get all these lackey-style responses. Why, the Fed has made the economy more stable. You don't want to go back to the 19th century, do you? All kinds of arguments like that. Well, you can blow those and others out of the water with my free ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed. Grab it at ourenemythefed.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here, and Saif Edeen Ammous is back with us again today. We're going to continue our conversation about his book, The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization. So we're going to continue a little bit on the economic angle, but then dive straight in to other topics, and we'll see how many of them we can get to. But my gosh, that table of contents is just full of things you're dying to flip to. So I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Saif, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me again.
All right. Now we're going to get into some different topics, let's say. I remember an essay. It might be an essay, but also then it was incorporated into Guido Holzman's book, The Ethics of Money Production, where he talks about not strictly economic consequences of fiat money inflation. And he says there are cultural consequences to having a money that loses its value. Even if it loses its value slowly, and not always rapidly, it still is losing its value, and that loss accumulates over time. And this has effects. For one thing, it makes younger people feel contemptuous of older people who try to teach them old-fashioned values like thrift, because thrift seems stupid in an inflationary environment. And so you can take and extend these insights into various aspects of human life into which you might not have peered to find effects of fiat money inflation. Well, you have your table of contents, I think, it drew me in more than probably any table of contents I've looked at in several years. I've never commented on a table of contents before in all the books I've talked about on this program, but your table of contents talks about fiat food and fiat energy and fiat universities. And I thought, wait a minute, I have to skip right. I already know the economics. I got to skip right to this stuff. So I want to talk about that. I know from reading your Twitter how you feel about food and what a lot of people eat. And I'm going to say a little something, by the way. I was in Las Vegas a week ago, and just for fun, we went to an interesting place, and maybe I won't mention the name, but yeah, I'm sure you can Google it easily enough. And the idea is that you are going to eat in the dark, and it's pitch black in there. Absolutely. The staff has to have some kind of special glasses to be able to see in the dark to bring you your food. But it's a fascinating experience. You have all the other senses, but you can't see anything, and they won't tell you what it is. Afterward, they'll show you what the menu was. And I'll tell you, this was a wonderful time. But there's an exception. On the menu at the end, one of the things we had eaten was so-called Beyond Meat. And I thought, only way you'd ever get me to eat this is if I was sitting in the dark and had no idea what was going on. So then I was looking at your book and I thought, oh, he would just be mortified. If Saif was ever in this situation, it would be very, very bad. So what do you mean about fiat food? And what is the connection between, I thought your discussion of the way inflation is concealed in connection to this was very interesting. How are these things related?
Yeah, so this is something that it's really been brewing inside my head for at least a decade. Holzman's book and essay were very influential in that. I'd also add, not particularly on diet, but I think, you know, the discussion of fiat and money and time preference. And also I'd add a great book by Ferdinand Lips, a Swiss banker who died a couple of decades ago, hugely influenced by the Austrians. And he wrote a book called Gold Wars on the history of gold as money. And that book really also drove this point home. So based on our discussion on yesterday's episode, I'd said how the way that this fiat system functions is that it takes away power and money and wealth from individuals and grants it to government. So on the one hand, it gives government the ability to shape reality increasingly because they have a lot of resources available to them and they don't have a lot of resource constraints. On the other hand, you know, the flip side to this is that the money is being devalued, and so people are witnessing their ability to provide for their future getting compromised increasingly the more that the money is devalued. So you look at a society where people have no way of securely saving something for 5 years, and you will see that it will be very different from a society that runs on a gold standard, where everybody knows that if you earn a gold coin and you hide it under your mattress and you take it out 10 years later, at the very least, it's going to buy something very similar to what you could buy 10 years ago. Most likely, it'll buy you slightly more. It appreciates. So with a gold standard, you have a reliable way of providing for your future. With fiat money, we took that away. So I think if you combine those two points, you know, on the one hand, government having more money and power, individuals having less money and power, and then on the other hand, the money losing value increases individuals' time preference. You combine those two things and apply them to any issue in the world, and I think they're going to be massively significant. They're going to be hugely influential about it. So in this second part of the book, which is called Fiat Life, I begin by then analyzing time preference and how fiat affects people's time preference, family, capital destruction, architecture. And then I apply it to food, I apply it to science, I apply it to education and the entire education system, and to energy, the discussion of energy, fuels, and what we see in the destruction of the reliable fuel technology that has built the modern world. You know, we see there's an insane crusade out there to try and get rid of the technology that's built the modern world and to replace it with unreliable forms of energy. So applying this to all kinds of different criteria, I found it to be very, very productive. And I think
can you take just a minute to explain, though, what time preference is, just so everybody knows?
Oh, yeah. So time preference refers to the degree to which an individual discounts the future compared to the present. So it's always positive because people always value the present more than the future. So if I gave you the choice between I'll give you a new phone, which you wanted today, or would I give you the same phone in a year, you'll obviously take it today. If I gave you the choice between $1 million today or $1 million in a year, assuming no change in purchasing power, it's the same $1 million, the same purchasing power, you'd prefer to take it today. So people always prefer the present to the future because the present is certain, whereas the future is uncertain. Human life is unpredictable. You never know when you might die. And because you want to consume the things, you want to invest them, you want to have them. So having things is better than not having them. So people always prefer the present over the future. Now, the degree to which they discount the future is what we call the time preference. So somebody with a high time preference discounts the future very heavily. So if I told you, you have a choice between $1 million today and $1 million next year, you'll choose today. But if I started raising the sum that I can give you next year, the more that I raise it, the more likely you are to decide to wait for a year. So somebody with a high time preference will require me to raise the amount significantly. You know, I'd need to offer them 3 million next year in order for them to give up on 1 million this year because they really, really want the 1 million right now and they can't wait. Somebody with a low time preference will accept maybe 1 million and 50,000 or 1 million, 1.1 million next year instead of the 1 million today, because they can wait and they value the future a lot. And so they think, yeah, well, 1.1 is probably better than one, so I'm going to wait. So for Austrians, obviously, you know, this time preference is an enormously important foundational aspect of economics. In fact, it's how we get interest rates. It's how we understand where interest rates come from. And I argue in my book, and I think this is, as far as I can tell, I think it is an original argument. I've not seen another Austrian make this argument, and it wouldn't be made by anyone other than an Austrian. I argue that the hardness of the money is like a control knob for our time preference. Because if you are able to, you know, if I take you and I put you in a society where money is being devalued at 50% per year, and that's your only option for saving, you know, your only way you can save for the future is hold money that's going to be worth 50% less next year, you're going to become a very high time preference person. You're not going to save anything. And your future is going to become uncertain. You know, say you're a 20-year-old or you're 15-year-old, you have no scope of thinking about what am I going to be doing in 10 years from now. You know, if you saved money at 15 for you to get married at 25, by the time you're 25, the money that you saved at 15 will basically be worthless. It'll be worth approximately zero. So you're going to have less of an incentive to think of the future in all aspects of your life. You're going to have less of an incentive to invest in a family, less of an incentive to invest in in anything that requires delayed gratification. Whereas, you know, if I moved you to a society where the money was very hard, so the money supply can't be increased, nobody can inflate the money supply easily, and you expect that the value of the money is going to go up every year by 10% because we make more of everything every year. There's more houses, more cars, more computers, and we don't make more money because the money is fixed in its supply. So every year you expect your money to increase in purchasing power by about 10%. In that kind of world, I'm going to expect you to have a very low time preference. You know, if every dollar that you have today, all you need to do is just not spend it today, and then next year you'll have 10% more in terms of real purchasing power. You don't have to invest. You don't have to take on any risk. You don't have to get into any businesses that you don't understand. You just take your money, whether it's a gold coin or a Bitcoin or whatever, and you stuff it under your mattress, physical or digital. And 1 year later, it can buy you 10% more apples, oranges, cars, houses. Well, in that kind of system, that kind of world, I'm going to expect 15-year-old you to have a lot of time thinking about their future. Financially, you're going to save. You know, at 15, you'll start mowing lawns and collecting as much money as you can. And guess what? You know, 10 years of 10% accumulation, that's more than double. So the money that you earn at 15 mowing lawns by the age of 25 when you want to get married, it's going to be worth something like 2.5 times as much as when you earned it. So it's a very strong incentive for you to save. And it's a way for you to think more about the future. And I think really, this is, I think, a very powerful explanatory tool. If you look around the world, you know, if you look at a society that goes through hyperinflation, you see everybody's very high time preference. Everybody gets their paycheck, runs to the supermarket, spends it all as soon as they get it because they know holding on to the money is a bad idea. And people live their entire lives. And I know this, I was living in Lebanon until very recently, and we saw hyperinflation over the last couple of years there. And I was, you know, I've been to visit and I see it. Everybody's lives is just about making ends meet for today, for this week, the end of the month. And then next month, God knows what's going to happen. You don't have the ability to think about it much. This is a very strong effect of fiat money that it has had on society. It's just historically, humans have moved toward harder and harder monies. And our monies keep getting harder and harder to make. You know, we used seashells and these kind of primitive forms of money and glass beads. Then we started using metals. Then within the metals, we started, the more successful monies were the harder metals. And then by the end of the 19th century, practically the entire planet was on a gold standard, and gold was increasing in its supply every year by around 2% only. So anybody anywhere on the planet by the end of the 19th century could save in a money that was only getting inflated in its supply by around 2%. This really is human progress. Like, this is what human progress has been. We're finding a harder money. Our money keeps getting harder because we keep accumulating more of it and the new production is still very tiny. So our money is harder. Our ability to provide for the future increases. Our desire to save and invest increases. And as a result, that's civilization. Our interest rates drop because time preference rises. People have more savings. So interest rates to borrow those savings decline. Capital is abundant. We have a lot of capital. We accumulate capital. Productivity rises. Living standards rise. This is civilization. And this is how humanity was progressing until the beginning of the 20th century, when we took a giant detour off the path of civilization and decided to try out this new form of money that increases by somewhere, anywhere between 5 and 500% per year. You know, the average increase is around 30% per year over the last 60 years, if you just count the numerical average. If you did a weighted average where each currency's value on the market, you know, the market capitalization of each currency is the weight of its inflation. So that in that kind of system, you know, the 30%, you're counting the Lebanese lira and the US dollar as both equal valuations. But if you did it where, you, but that's not entirely fair because, you know, a lot more people use the dollar. If you did it to weigh things according to the size of each of the currencies, you still end up with about 14% annual increase average over the last 60 years. So between 1960 and 2020, the world's money was increasing at an average of about 14%. The average fiat money user witnessed a 14% increase in the supply of their currency every year, which is astonishing because a century earlier, their grandparents could save in a money that was only increasing at 2% per year. So the result of this is that it causes everybody to discount the future more and prioritize the present more. That's the kind of underlying fundamental explanation of all the bad things that we saw in the 20th century. We've reversed the process of civilization. That's why, you know, the subtitle for my book is, sounds outlandishly crazy at some point, but I think I've tried to make the case for it. Initially, when I said, you know, that the universalization of debt, everybody has to get into debt, and everybody becomes a debt slave, and also it's an alternative to human civilization. We stop lowering our time preference. We stop accumulating more and more capital. We accumulate less capital. We destroy the capital that we have. We consume a lot of the capital. And we really reverse and destroy human civilization. We launch world wars because insane governments now have access to endless money printers. I think most of us have this idea that progress is inevitable, that the world gets better, technology gets better, and the world gets better. But I think writing this book made me realize that the last century has been regression in the human condition in many ways. Yes, technology has continued to advance. Mainly, it was the 19th century technology that we just continued to develop in the 20th century. But I think if we continue on a fiat system for another 50 years, it's now becoming apparent to more and more people just how unsustainable it is and how destructive it is. And I think if we continue on fiat, I think things will get much, much, much worse because of these underlying trends that I mentioned, because we're going to continue to have our money increase in supply by 10, 20, 30% or so. And we're going to continue to see people discount the future more. We're going to continue to see governments have more and more power and money. But fortunately, Bitcoin fixes this.
All right, but let's go to the connection between all this and food.
Yeah, so with food, well, food and energy are basically the two most important things that people buy. The two biggest, most price-sensitive items on people's shopping list. So everybody needs to eat and everybody needs to have energy sources if they want to live in the modern world. You know, you need machines, you need electricity, you need fuel, you need to move your machines around, move your cars. So those two things are a big chunk of everybody's budget, a big chunk of everybody's spending. And so they're extremely politically sensitive issues. If the price of food goes up, politicians are very, very worried. You know, people will be out in the street and elections won't go the way that you want them to go. So if you look at how governments have dealt with food since the 1970s, in particular after 1971, because 1971 is when the US removed the last link of gold redemption. So gold was still redeemable from the US government, from the central banks of the rest of the world. They could still redeem gold up until 1971. After 1971, nobody could redeem any of the dollars for gold. And so the restraint on the US government to print money or to lend money, create new credit, was removed. And so the money supply started increasing very quickly. And as a result, of course, surprise, surprise, prices started to increase very quickly, both for prices of food and prices of energy. And what we saw there is that, of course, as with every government that has ever existed in history, every single thing on earth was blamed for the rise in prices, except, of course, for the printing of the money, for the increase in the money supply. So what governments did in the 1970s, particularly the US government, was that they tried to get their people to eat cheap stuff instead of the expensive stuff whose price is rising. And that's really the best way to understand all of the idiotic pseudoscience that is taught in modern universities under the pretext of being nutrition science. It's all motivated by the idea that we need to get people to eat cheap crap instead of eating the expensive stuff that makes prices go up. So you look at the 1970s, I mean, the stories are almost unbelievable. And when the price of eggs rose, a president, I think it was Johnson, I'm not sure who it was. I have the story and the details in the book. But the president called the Surgeon General and told him, listen, we have a problem with eggs. Prices of eggs keep going up. We don't know why that's the case.
Yeah, this is Johnson. I read this in your book. Yeah, it is Johnson.
Johnson, yeah. The price of eggs keeps going up. We need to find a fix for this. Can you tell people that eggs are bad, that they shouldn't be eating a lot of eggs? And lo and behold, the Surgeon General goes and says, yeah, actually, eggs have cholesterol, and that's not good for you. You should be eating a lot of eggs.
I mean, this seems impossible, right? This seems like something you and I would make up.
I know. It's amazing. They just continue to come, like all of these stories. Like I read about a lot of this stuff from the context of reading about nutrition, you know, reading about the equivalent of the Austrian school in nutrition. There are heretics in nutrition, just like us in economics. And they mentioned those things without much focus on the economic underlying factors, without much understanding of the inflation and so on. But if you have that idea of, if you know what happened with the inflation, then you can connect the dots. And you see, in the 1970s, suddenly all of these government agencies are telling people to eat cheap stuff. And then perhaps the more significant example is the rise of industrial agriculture, which was deliberate government policy. Nixon appointed a guy called Earl Butz as Department of Agriculture Secretary. Earl Butz went to American farmers and said, go big or go home. We need to industrialize. We need to do mass scale farming in order to bring costs down. And so we moved from the model of, you know, small farms, ranches, a family of six who have a farm with a few cows and a few crops that they grow and they sell in the local market. All of that became unfeasible in the 1970s. Earl Butz came to all of those small farmers, bought them out or forced them to consolidate, and got big, massive corporations to buy up all the land, tear down all of these, you know, small little veggie patches here and there and small little barns, and turn everything into these massive monocropped fields because that's more efficient. And so it's more efficient economically. Yeah, you can make more corn if you have, you know, if you take 100 small farms and you raise everything, you know, 100 small farms with 100 small families, growing various crops, including corn, and growing their own animals. You have 100 healthy farms. And if you get into how the soil is managed, you know, you need the animals along with the crops because the crops deplete the soil of nutrients. The animals replenish the soil when they defecate in it. And that's the cycle that keeps the earth healthy and that keeps the soil healthy and fertile. So you take out those 100 farms, and you get Archer Daniel Midland to own those 100 farms and raise everything and turn it all into just one row after row after row of corn with these giant, massive combine harvesters running through it. You make much more corn than you did with the 100 families. But of course, the quality of the corn declines and the nutritious value of the corn declines. So this is what started in the 1970s. It's let's find a way to make food cheaper. And the way that they made it cheaper was to compromise on the quality. And then the other way that they made it cheaper was to compromise the quality and to tell people that it's actually better for you to eat the cheap crap that's making you sick. And that the healthy things that all of your ancestors have eaten for millions of years, the reason that we as human beings became human beings is the fact that we eat meat and that we can hunt it. It's why our brains are so big because we eat a lot of meat, and that somehow in the 1970s became unhealthy. We've had government being extremely activist in trying to tell people to stop eating meat because it's bad for the environment, because it's bad for you, because it causes heart disease, it causes colon cancer, it's bad for your kidneys. All of that is completely rubbish pseudoscience and basically inflationist propaganda. The only problem with meat is that it's more expensive. And that it's not easy. Well, there's two problems. It's expensive and it's not easy to industrialize it and bring costs down like you can with corn and soy and all these other crops. Because with these crops, you know, the more industrial power you bring into the production of the crops, the cheaper you can make them. It's almost like producing plastic goods. In a sense, they are plastic. You're putting plastic fertilizer on the soil, throwing in a seed, and a few weeks later, you harvest that plastic fertilizer in these crops that are very cheap. and very harmful. So we witnessed in the 70s the rise of the dietary guidelines, where the government is telling everybody you need 6 to 11 rations of grain a day, and that you should cut down on meat, and that you should cut down on saturated fat, and that you should use, and this is maybe the biggest crime of the century. You know, that's a lot of competition in this century. But perhaps the biggest crime of the century was the idea that you shouldn't use animal fats, but you should use industrial seed oils. You should use all of these very cheap oils that are produced in mass scale, canola oil and rapeseed oil and mazola oil and corn oil. All of these industrial oils, they might just be the worst thing that you can do for your body. I think if you don't want to take anything from what I say about food seriously, you just want to take one thing, remove all of that seed oil from your house. Never, ever, ever use it in your house ever again. And only cook with ghee or tallow or butter, animal fats only. That on its own, you know, you can still eat all the things that you want to eat, but just cook them in that fat. You're going to witness an indescribable improvement in your health if you just get rid of that absolute poison. The seed oils, vegetable oils is another word that people call them. They're not made from vegetables, but you know, it's marketing. But anyways, all of these plant oils, if you just get rid of them and you replace them with animal fats, it's an enormous improvement. But of course, that's not what the government has been telling you. So since the 70s, we have the government on the one hand pushing for the industrialization, pushing for bringing costs down, and pushing people to eat the industrial food that is low cost. So 50 years on, what has been the harvest of this? Well, the harvest has been that people eat a lot of junk and people get sick. And so we see that as the consumption of those things went up, the government policy has actually been successful. They've managed to get people to eat a lot more of this junk. And the result has been massive increase in obesity, in diabetes, and in all kinds of health problems. And of course, massive depletion of the soil, which is an excellent example of high time preference. You know, keeping the soil healthy is a very low time preference thing that we do. But exploiting the soil for maximum gain today is a very high time preference thing. You know, you milk the soy dry in order to get the biggest paycheck you can get today, and then you end up with barren land. And that's what a lot of the US and the world is today. Like if you fly over the US, you see a lot of the land there is just for a few couple of months of the year, it's full of crops. But for the rest of the year, it's you fly over and it's just barren. And it's land that wouldn't produce anything without fertilizer. There's no nutrients left in the soil. And this has been going on for 50 years. Recently, a lot more people are waking up to it. You know, you witness the rise of people becoming aware of the damage of seed oils, people becoming aware of the importance of meat, the rise of people eating carnivore diets and low-carb diets and witnessing amazing improvements. And of course, the astonishing thing here is, I mean, there have been millions of people all over the world who have improved their lives by bucking the recommendations of the US dietary guidelines, by doing the exact opposite of everything that nutrition departments and doctors have been telling people for 50 years. And of course, because this is all fiat world, absolutely no interest among the fiat institutions to reverse track on any of this. I mean, Harvard Medical School and Harvard Nutrition School are still telling people to eat the industrial waste, and they're still telling people that eating meat is bad for you.
How does this analysis, though, get applied to energy policy or preferring inferior energy over superior energy? I mean, the health effects of, let's say, these industrial seed oils are not instantly evident as soon as you consume it, whereas most people can kind of get that these alternative forms of energy are unreliable and more expensive. They can see that right off the bat. So what's the mechanism here?
Yeah, I think it's a similar process. Also in the 1970s, the price of energy went up, and also governments started supporting any kind of stupid excuse they could come up with that explains why it's actually not the fault of all of the money printing that we're doing. It's the fault of the Saudis, and it's the fault of the Arab-Israeli war, and it's the fault of peak oil. We're just running out of oil. It's nothing to do with inflation. And it's actually the fault of climate change. Well, we can't use oil anyway. Even if we're not running out of it, we shouldn't be using more of it because it's going to destroy the planet. So once we get into this inflationary world of the 1970s, governments have a serious problem with people consuming oil because oil just keeps getting more expensive because, you know, being able to deliver it in the right place at the right time, getting it and being able to consume it. If there's inflation, you know, the people who run the supply chain, they have to be very responsive to it because it's a very sophisticated supply chain and it's a very liquid good. So you're constantly burning oil, like literally burning. And so you're running oil through the pipeline of the supply chains all the time. And as soon as the inflation hits, the price has to rise. And so in the 1970s, the price of a barrel of oil went from $2 to about $30 or $40 by the end of the 1970s. It was an enormous increase. And, you know, by the 1970s, America in particular had become completely dependent on oil. And I don't say the word dependent in a bad way. You know, that's a good thing. It's good that we're dependent on oil because the alternative is that, you know, we're poor and broke and miserable and immobile and cold and dying in the winter. Technology is a good thing. Energy consumption is a good thing. The more energy that we consume, the better our life is. And if you look historically, since the start of the Industrial Revolution, we've had a global trend of 2% per capita increase in annual energy production, 2% increase in energy consumption per capita per year. And that trend continued from the early 19th century up until 1970. So for almost for a century and a half to two centuries or so, that trend was continued. And then in the 1970s, it broke down. And we've basically been flat since the 1970s, energy consumption per capita. I mean, not exactly flat, but it hasn't kept up with the increase that had been going on. And I think what happened was that because of the inflation, we've witnessed the rise of all of these insane death cults. And again, there's a lot of it that's religious. Similarly with food, you know, a lot of these Christian groups that view meat eating as a sin started becoming extremely popular and influential in the 1970s because governments liked that message. And similarly, you have a lot of religious and arguably pagan influenced groups that view humanity as a burden on earth and that view nature and earth as being pure and that humans are evil who come and ruin everything. That suddenly started becoming really popular in the 1970s. And you had cranks like Paul Ehrlich come up with all these ideas about we're running out of resources and there's a population bomb and we're all going to die and we're all going to starve. And all these incredible predictions about, you know, by the year 1982, there's not going to be any more oil left. And by 84, there's not going to be any nickel left and so on. And all these doomsday cults basically started to flourish in the 1970s. And I think, you know, there's a reason that all these doomsday cults flourish in the modern cult factory that is the modern university, because the university is funded by government and governments want to, you know, hear these messages. I mean, again, this isn't you know, some overarching conspiracy where somebody's sitting in an office planning all of this out. It's just, if you come up with a story that says, hey, people need to consume more oil in order to survive, that's going to be pretty inconvenient for people who are signing off on your budget. And again, we live in a world in which scientific research has also become all fiat because it's all captured by government resources. It's all funded by government. So we get all of these insane ideas that, you know, and of course, then that mutated and to the biggest one. All of the doomsday scenarios, they had a natural problem that they couldn't run with these doomsday scenarios for very long because you can, you know, you can only say the sky is falling tomorrow so many times before people stop believing you. So you lose your credibility after a while. You've made hundreds of these predictions. So in the statist fiat marketplace of ideas, the idea that I think was most suited for surviving was the doomsday cult of climate change, because that's like a very good cult leader, because it makes no testable predictions whatsoever. Everything confirms climate change. You know, if it rains too much this year, it's because of climate change. If it rains too little, that's also because of climate change. And if it rains close to the average, well, guess what? There's annual temperatures and there's the number of storms and there's all kinds of other things that you could look at that are different. And whatever is outside of, you know, the 95% observations, whatever is an extreme observation anywhere in the world, is evidence of climate change. And that's how this insane doomsday cult functions. You know, obviously, there's always extraordinary things happening all over the world. You know, every day, hundreds of people worldwide win the lottery. It's an extremely unlikely thing. But there are so many extremely unlikely things that could possibly happen that we get so many of them actually happening, you know? So every day, there's a place that's witnessing record rainfall or record snow, record high temperature, record low temperature. And of course, you know, as technology expands and as the world expands, we're just collecting more and more and more of this data in more places and being able to come up with new extremes. So all of these can be attributed to climate change. What the implication of all of these doomsday scenarios, you know, the highest level of rainfall in Arkansas this year, oh no, doomsday. The implication is, well, you need to stop consuming the expensive forms of energy and you need to start consuming the forms of energy that don't work, basically, that are extremely cheap and that are useless. You know, the motivation is that solar and wind for them is that they're going to reduce the damage from climate change. But in reality, solar and wind cannot provide us with a reliable energy to meet our needs, and they cannot provide us with the high power that we need. That's really the key point that I stress, is that what hydrocarbons and oil and gas allow us is high power on demand wherever we want it, anytime, you know, at the margin. That's why it's very valuable. Whereas wind and solar, you know, you can't control how much energy they give you. So they are basically completely useless for a modern industrial society. They're completely superfluous. They're just, we can build an economy on solar and wind, and that's a 15th century economy. You know, since the 15th century, we've started using coal, and that's really changed the world. You know, the use of gas and oil has completely transformed humanity because of the availability of high power. And now fiat is trying to take that away from us because inflation makes it impossible for us to maintain the extremely sophisticated division of labor and supply chain that we need in order to make this work. When you're constantly robbing everybody, you're making it very hard for them to continue to buy those sources of energy that they need. And you're making the supply chains more and more tenuous. And we see this in the 70s, where I discussed it in my book. But I think you see this now, the same people, the same exact people that tell you that inflation is not a problem, that Bitcoin is a bad idea, Bitcoin is stupid, gold is stupid, Austrian economics is stupid. It's an astonishing coincidence, isn't it, that these very same exact people also happen to believe that hydrocarbon energy, that fossil fuels are bad for the planet, and that the alternative are cheap, pre-industrial, unworkable technologies like solar and wind. And they also happen to believe that meat is bad for the planet, that cow farts are boiling the oceans, and that CO2, by rising from 0.02% to 0.04% of the atmosphere, CO2 is going to basically destroy life on Earth. I don't think it's a coincidence that those same people believe all of those ideas. It's the inflation cult. It's the people who are paid by inflation, and their entire worldview is shaped by inflation and shaped in a way that defends inflation. They want to see more and more inflation, and they want to secure more inflation. And there's an enormous, enormous intellectual industrial complex out there to tell people to stop consuming the things that they need for their life, which are because these things are inconvenient for inflation. And it's an extremely unpopular position to take in this book, but in this book, I'm standing up and I'm calling their bluff. And very, very few people will say this. Very few people will tell you that this entire climate change hysteria is a load of complete nonsense. And that's what I'm saying. And the entirety of modern nutrition science is a load of complete nonsense. And not only am I saying is it both those things nonsense, they are nonsense because they are motivated by hiding inflation. I'm arguing that this is just how the inflation beneficiaries, the fiat privilege, the people with fiat privileges, I like to call them, this is the world that they need. They need a world in which people eat bugs, they eat soy, they eat industrial manufactured crap, and they consume very little energy. And if you have that, then yeah, inflation won't be bad. this is what we're seeing right now. And I think the lockdown cult, the insane fanatics that promoted this insane massive mass crime against humanity that is the lockdown, are also motivated by this to an extent. And then now this is, you're already hearing the same insane people talking about, well, we're going to need lockdowns for climate. It's not a lockdown for climate, it's a lockdown for inflation. If you stay home, if you don't leave your house, if you eat bug soy burgers delivered to you at home with, you know, the little tiny little drones, and if you stop living in a big house that you get to live a comfortable life in a big house, you know, we should stop that because that consumes a lot of oil and that's, you know, bad for boiling oceans or whatever. So if we convince you to move everybody to tiny little apartments where the cost of heating goes down significantly and the cost of transportation goes down significantly, everybody's locked down, everybody's eating bug soy burgers, well, guess what? The inflation problem's been solved, Tom. There is no inflation.
Hey, everybody, just a quick word of thanks to Skillshare, the online learning community that is sponsoring this episode. They've been so good to the Tom Woods Show, and they're offering our listeners a one-month free trial. So I hope you'll make 2022 a year of new learning, growth, and connection through creativity with online classes from Skillshare. There are so many fascinating classes on Skillshare, you're not going to believe it. Thousands and thousands of them that you get with just one membership. So we're talking illustration, design, photography, animation, productivity, and way, way more. Like, for example, this one I stumbled upon at random, and I thought, yeah, this would be wonderful to know. Indoor gardening, grow houseplants, veggies, and herbs with Etka Chowdhury. The classes are short and manageable, so you can introduce something new and exciting into your life without making a massive sacrifice. Skillshare has classes for every skill level, and with short lessons, hands-on projects, classes designed for real life, you can tap into the creativity you have got inside. Skillshare helps you move your creative journey forward without putting life on hold. You'll create real projects, you'll get the support of your fellow creatives, so you can accomplish real growth. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a one-month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods. The point you made, and I know that the problems with so-called measuring inflation, and one of the problems is the quality of the goods that you're buying. It is hard to make these so-called hedonic adjustments because if I can no longer get that ribeye steak for $20 because the ribeye steak is now $100, so instead I get a very, very low grade of meat for $20, it looks like, you know, my basket of goods still has quote-unquote meat in it. And so officially everything looks okay, but it's really not okay because I wanted the ribeye steak and I can't have it anymore. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, your table of contents absolutely drew me in. So I don't want to give the impression that this is the entirety of your book, but some of your section titles run like this: Fiat Architecture, Fiat Capital Destruction, Fiat Family, Fiat Farms, Fiat Diets, Fiat Foods, Fiat Soils, and then Fiat Schools, Universities, Academics, Fiat Science. I think we've endured plenty of that. And it just goes on and on. This is a fascinating application of these important ideas. But then also, there's a lot of great and important economics in this book. And if we had more time, I would have talked a little bit more about the cost-benefit analysis of Bitcoin versus fiat. I've done that a little bit, you know, because they try to say Bitcoin uses up too much energy, or gold mining, as Milton Friedman thought, was a waste of resources if we can just print pieces of paper. I've kind of hit on that before, and I think people can get the sense of what the way to think about that is. If fiat has all these terrible consequences and sound money has these good consequences, then whatever expenses are associated with sound money are an absolute bargain. Give us a final word before we wrap up for today.
Yeah, this is exactly it. I think, you know, a lot of these insane fiat privileged people are always going on about, oh no, Bitcoin is consuming so much energy. These same people who fly their private jets, of course, all over the world and consuming energy. And I have no problem with them flying their private jets. I dream of a world in which we have 1,000 times as many airplanes flying all over the world and cars and much more energy consumption. I'd love to see the world consume 100 times more energy than it does today, because I think that's a good thing. Because energy consumption is how things get better. You know, we used to wash our clothes with our hands and now we use washing machines. Washing machines consume a lot more energy than hand. And a lot of the people that want to defend Bitcoin, I think, make a very, very big mistake, which is no, actually, Bitcoin doesn't consume that much energy. And here's a bunch of complicated math to show you why it's actually not that bad. No, it does consume a lot of energy. The washing machine does consume a lot more energy than you sitting there and trying to wash your clothes with your own hand. You don't need a generator with electricity connected to you in order to wash it. But there's basically nobody in the world who can have a washing machine who doesn't have it. I've never heard of anybody who had a washing machine and then decided, nah, you know what? I'm going to spend 3 days a week doing my own laundry with my own hands. I've never heard of somebody like that. Everybody, you know, people like to virtue signal all kinds of nonsense, but when it comes to actions, that's when you can tell what they really believe. And everybody believes in the washing machine. Everybody believes in spending more electricity on washing than just using their hands. And I am one of those people. And the difference between me and most people is that I defend it and I'm not ashamed of it. Yes, I want to consume as much energy as I possibly can. I'd like to automate more and more things in my life so that I have more time to do things that I enjoy to do, so that I can spend time with my family instead of having to spend time washing. And I'd like to drive my family in a car rather than having to walk with them everywhere. And so if you want to cross the Atlantic, you can take a kayak. You can also take an airplane. Again, we don't see many people taking a kayak, even though it doesn't consume a lot of energy. Why? Why do all of these people still insist on taking the airplane? Because it's faster, it's safer, it's cheaper, and it's much better. And so the energy consumption is definitely worth it. So why is it that people want to spend all of this energy on Bitcoin? To answer that question, I think we need to look at the opportunity cost. And this is really the economic way of thinking. You can't just look at one thing. You have to look at the seen and the unseen. So it's not that people are just spending this money on Bitcoin in a vacuum. You know, they're spending it on Bitcoin because there is an alternative. And the alternative is the Canadian dollar, the Lebanese lira, the Venezuelan bolivar, all these dysfunctional socialist shitholes that have dysfunctional currencies that are destroying their societies, that are making people literally starve, that are making people hungry, that are making people broke and destitute. This is what fiat has done. So fiat, as I was saying earlier, it offers us 14% inflation per year. So we're having the supply increase by 14%. So anybody who holds fiat is just getting poorer. So there you go. That's the first reason. We're getting a 14% devaluation of everybody's wealth in order to finance insane governments and their spending. It's a very high tax. And if you think about 14%, 14% of the liquid wealth of the world, there's about $190 trillion of liquid fiat money around in checking accounts and saving accounts and cash around the world. And that's being diluted at around 14% per year. So we're talking about several trillion. I can't remember the exact numbers, but we're talking about something in the range of $10 trillion a year that are being lost to inflation. That's what Bitcoin fixes. So just like, you know, with crossing the Atlantic with an airplane, why don't you take a kayak? Exactly. You know, why don't the Lebanese people just stick to the Lebanese lira? It's environmentally friendly. It doesn't consume a lot of electricity. And it doesn't need all of this complicated machinery that Bitcoin uses. Sounds like a very reasonable thing to ask of them, right? Well, no. As somebody who survived a hyperinflation in Lebanon, thanks to Bitcoin, I'll tell you that Bitcoin was more valuable for me than any of the machines. Maybe not more valuable than my laptop, maybe my phone. Actually, probably more valuable than them. Definitely more valuable than my washing machine, than my car, than all of these things. Like if I had to choose where do I put my energy, where do I get to spend energy, if in the coming ESG dystopia where you need to do carbon accounting for everything, I would have happily given up all my rest of carbon emissions in order to keep the Bitcoin carbon emissions, you know, because it's really worth it. It was very, very much worth it. Like I don't just write about Bitcoin as somebody who's a big fan of Bitcoin because I enjoy it. It saved my life. I'd be in a very, 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 very bad place today if I didn't have Bitcoin. And if I'd listened to all those insane fiat people who tell us that Bitcoin is too expensive, if I hadn't woken up from the hysterical education that I got at Columbia University about carbon and all of this nonsense. And if I believed this bullshit and I thought to myself, oh yeah, well, Bitcoin, nah, that's consuming too much energy. I'm not going to use it. If I was that stupid, I'd be destitute today. And because I understood that this is technology and because I'm not an insane Luddite who thinks, you know, machines are bad, I understood that this is a machine that's going to consume more electricity, and it saved my life. So if we think about the costs of fiat that Bitcoin is allowing people to escape, number one, we have the inflation, which is very clear and very obvious. You have all of the economic destruction that inflation brings about, business cycles, and you know the financial crises and all of that stuff, which as Austrian, I'm sure you're very familiar with. Then you have the problem of government spending, the fact that it just creates all of these omnipotent governments all over the world. And people think of government spending as a benefit from fiat. For me, it's destructive on top of its cost. Like, I think, you know, the best thing that you could do with tax money, if you had a, you know, the best thing that the US government could do with the tax money, or any government for that matter, is take all of that money and put it in the president's own private bank account in Switzerland. Like, if all of the US taxpayers' money went to Switzerland in one person's bank account, the US would be better off than the government getting that money and spending it. You know, the problem with taxation, and I think Peter Schiff says this, the problem with taxation is not just the fact that they take money from you. That's like when they put the knife in, and then taking the knife out, which hurts even more, is when they spend that money and then distort the economy. So then we have all of these distortions that are being enabled, which I discussed in Fiat Life, food and education and science and all that stuff. All of these distortions are being enabled by fiat money. And of course, I think the biggest one, the most important one, even bigger than inflation and business cycle, is conflict. Ultimately, fiat is might makes right. There's no restraint on how much money the top dog in a fiat system has. You know, as we saw in Canada, you know, being Prime Minister of Canada right now and being Prime Minister of any country, any fiat country in the world, allows you basically unlimited access to money. Like, all of Canadian society's wealth is Justin Trudeau's. He can do with it as he pleases. He can shut down your bank account. He can give you money. He can take money from anybody and give it to anybody else. The entire system functions in a way where the people in power get to control it. So what does this lead to? It leads to a lot of conflict over power. It leads to a lot of domestic conflict. Politics becomes a very high stakes game with fiat, because being the person in charge, like being the president of any particular country, allows you to assign and confiscate wealth as you please. So people are going to go to great lengths to secure that for themselves. And that means getting into a lot of conflicts domestically, but also internationally. War. That's the real cost of the fiat system. First of all, it allows governments to finance themselves into war. And that's why World War I and World War II happened. And well, maybe not started, but that's what allowed them to drag on for so long, because governments could just keep printing more and more money. But also, it creates a bigger incentive for conflict beyond just the financing, which is that the stakes are very high. You know, Iran and the US, the stakes are extremely high because of the fact that the US can weaponize its financial system against Iran. So Iran has a very strong incentive to not play along. And the US has a very strong incentive to use its ability to control the fiat monetary system to try and impose its will on Iran. All of that stuff is because we have this insane monetary system where value is determined by a bunch of people who are in charge, who are in power, which is not the case with gold and not the case with Bitcoin. And, you know, you need to mine the gold, which costs money in order to make it, or mine the Bitcoin, or you got to earn it. You got to provide something of value for others. Fiat destroys society because it makes it so that all of the productive people can't get ahead, and the parasites can. And the people who get into conflict, the violent people, they are the ones who can get ahead because they get to control the printing presses.
Well, on that note, I guess it should be obvious by now how important it is for you all to read this book, which is, once again, The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization. Linking to it at tomwoods.com/2071. I know that we might think at a time like this that the issue of money is kind of abstruse and technical and not really our central concern. But if you've been really paying attention, you see that it always is really at the very least, beneath the surface as an issue. And so with the situation in Canada, now it's even above the surface. It's very obvious how important it is to get the money right. This is not just some academic question that we can relegate to the nerds in our movement. We all need to be engaged on this topic because it is so fundamental. It is the base upon which so much else rests. So we have to get this right. And getting it right begins by reading the Saifedean books, the Bitcoin Standard, and now more recently, the Fiat Standard. Thanks so much for your time today, Saif.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
All right, everybody, from one important book to another, tomorrow we talk to our old friend James Lindsay, who just released a brand new book called Race Marxism, The Truth About Critical Race Theory and Practice. So you will not want to miss that one. If you like and appreciate the Old Tom Wood Show, join me as a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. You get way more stuff from me than you get from any other podcaster. I'm just going to say that, okay? You get way, way more stuff from me. Go check it out. Think I'm lying? Go to supportinglisteners.com. You get way, way more stuff from me than anybody else gives you. All right. That's all I have to say. Plus, you get way more episodes too. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.